They came from way far out in outer space. She's hard to miss, and so they landed on her face. She's got cooties. They found a place to nest. If I were her, I'd be depressed. Long tail, sharp nail, fuzzy legs, laying eggs. Oh no! She's like a walking show and tell. Her pets don't ran away cause it couldn't take the smell. She's got cooties. Nobody wants to sit by her. No, don't need a coat cause she's got fur. Circle, circle, da, da, da. Glad I got my cootie shot.
And welcome to WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo, and we were listening, of course, to the song Cooties from the play and movie Hairspray. And we're here to find out all about the cooties that are out there today. And it's on the being called, what, coronavirus, COVID-9, all these different words, names. And we're going to try and parse through all that stuff in the next 60 minutes and talk about how it affects us here in New York. I know that I've met many people who've been very, very nervous. They're hearing several different opinions at the same time that seem to be contradictory and self-contradictory. The reason is, I think, from all the reading I've been doing, is that, in fact, we don't know. There hasn't been enough testing, and there's little knowledge about what's going on here. And so whenever there's an unknown, there's, of course, fear. And in the recent – here's some of the recent headlines: the spreading new virus or fears of it immobilized cruise ships or left them searching for ports on four continents Saturday as the bug that has infected more than 100,000 people shifted its travel patterns. Iran declared a sacred jihad against the virus after its case numbers spiked anew. Italy shut down its courts, and the Vatican decided to live stream the Pope's Sunday blessings. Cruise ships faced trouble in waters of the United States, Malaysia, Egypt, and Malta as those aboard got tested or confined to cabins. In China, the number of people recovering from COVID-19 mounted, but hopeful signs had not erased the scope of the recent crisis in the country, where the new virus emerged late last year. A hotel used for the medical observation of people who had contacted with infected patients collapsed on Saturday in southeastern China, trapping some 70 people. There are no immediate reports of deaths. At least 23 people were rescued from the wreckage of the Xinjia Express Hotel in Guangzhou, the Communist Party newspaper People's Daily and other outlets reported. After the city of Venice canceled its cherished carnival and governments warned citizens against travel to Italy, the epicenter of Europe's outbreak, the country is facing a possible recession. Officials in California were deciding Saturday where to dock the Grand Princess cruise ship with 3,500 people aboard after 21 tested positive for the virus. There is evidence the ship, now idling off San Francisco, was the breeding ground for a deadly cluster of 10 cases during an earlier voyage. In Egypt, a cruise ship on the Nile with more than 150 aboard was under quarantine in the southern city of Luxor after 12 tested positive for the virus. The passengers include American, French, and Indian travelers. As of Saturday, nearly 90,000 cases have been reported in Asia, more than 7,000 in Europe, and some 5,000 in the Mideast, about 400 in North America, about 50 in Latin America and the Caribbean, and fewer than 50 cases reported so far in Africa. The virus is still much less widespread than annual flu epidemics, which cause up to 5 million severe cases around the world and 290,000 to 650,000 deaths annually, according to the World Health Organization. And Western countries stepped up efforts to control the outbreak. In the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is urging older adults and people with severe medical conditions such as heart, lung, or kidney disease to stay home as much as possible and avoid crowds. Four U.S. universities said campuses would hold classes online instead of in person after schools in Asia and Europe did the same. Pope Francis will deliver his next two public blessings via video rather than in person to prevent crowds from gathering. Austria confiscated 21,000 disposable masks that a Turkish company smuggled aboard a tour bus, seeking to profit from soaring demand. Turkish police, meanwhile, said Saturday they would take legal action against social media accounts accused of spreading false virus information. Nine countries that contribute troops and police to the UN's 95,000-strong peacekeeping operations are delaying bringing in replacements for 3 months. On the economic sector, China, the world's biggest trader, reported Saturday its exports tumbled 17.2% from a year earlier in January. In February, imports sank 4%. Beijing's decision to keep factories and offices empty as its outbreak advanced sent shockwaves to production of the world's smartphones, toys, and other consumer goods. President Donald Trump on Friday signed a bill to provide $8.3 billion to bolster the capacity to test for coronavirus and fund other measures in the United States. Cases have now been reported in more than half of the 50 U.S. states. 15 people have died in the United States. In many affected countries, people were being asked to stay home from work. Schools were closed. Large gatherings, sports events, and music events were canceled. Stores were cleared of staples like toiletries and water, and face masks became a common sight. In the South by Southwest Music Festival and Tech Festival held in Austin every year, Austin, Texas, and two music festivals in Florida have been canceled over concerns about events that bring crowds of people into close proximity. The NCAA Division III men's basketball tournament was scheduled to go ahead at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore this weekend, but without spectators. Very interesting. So we see that this is what they call a pandemic, which is a euphemism, a nice word for epidemic, which has a much more ominous tone to it. It's spreading around the country, around the world, and it is already here. It pretty much is already here. And of course, people are fearful. And you know, this is where we're going to go into and talk more about exactly what the science of this is with Kurt Williamson, who is a professor, associate professor of biology at William & Mary College in Virginia. And we interviewed him. He's going to talk for about 6 minutes about just what a virus is, what coronavirus is, how it is different and the same from the flu, and why it's causing so much concern when the flu, which is around all the time, you know, actually seems to be a more threatening illness, right? It's something that we never even take for granted. I think most people didn't know that hundreds of thousands of people die from the flu around the world every year. It can be a serious disease to people with a poor immune system. But there are differences between the flu virus and the virus, the bug, the little bug that makes coronavirus, that has the experts worried. So we're going to go to Kurt Williamson, professor, associate professor of biology and a virologist, an expert on viruses, to tell us more about that.
A professor of biology at the College of William & Mary is Kurt Williamson. He explains what makes a virus tick and why the coronavirus is so dangerous.
Viruses are acellular parasites, so they use cells and organisms made out of cells to make more of themselves. Outside of a cell, they don't do much. What is a coronavirus? So viruses as a group is very broad and diverse. And so coronavirus is one subcategory of viruses in the breadth of what viruses are. So there are viruses that infect bacteria. There are viruses that infect fungi. There are viruses that infect animals. And then within animals, you know, there are viruses that infect humans. There are viruses that infect dogs, horses, etc. Coronavirus is just a grouping of genetically related viruses.
And then what happens? It takes over the cell and destroys it, right?
Pretty much. The destruction is sort of like a side effect for most viruses. Like the cell is so overtaken with performing viral functions that it's not seeing to its own maintenance.
Why is this different from the flu and other bugs that we get?
A lot of scientists are still waiting to see exactly what is different about this. There's kind of two main ingredients that make virus A more of a problem than virus B. One is, what kind of cells can it get into? This is a problem with, say, the Ebola virus. It can get into many different kinds of cells in our body. So different organ systems, different tissues are all being affected at the same time. And so it's kind of a system overload. For this coronavirus, I think part of it is the tissues that it targets. It also seems to go to the lungs. And so that is a sensitive target in that if it impacts the breathing too much, the host, which is us, really suffers the second component then of how serious the virus is how much of an immune response does it stimulate? A lot of what we sort of look at as virus symptoms, a lot of it is just our immune response. So influenza really does a good job at almost overstimulating the immune response. So you feel a lot of times headache, joint pain, you know, inflammation. People describe sort of like this being hit by a train. You know, that is essentially flu triggering an immune response, and it's that immune response that makes you just feel so crummy. Most of the cases that have resulted in death, there's some sort of other underlying problem. So it makes, like, once you have the virus causing damage and amplifying an immune system on top of that condition, it really, again, ends up in sort of a system overload. More people who recover are dealing just with the virus without other complicating factors.
Older people are the target, seem to be the most susceptible.
It's constantly changing picture, and so until all the data are in, we won't know for sure exactly why this strain of coronavirus is more of a problem than, say, other circulating strains that are already in the human population.
Is testing important, and why is that important?
Yes, testing is important. In order for all medical professionals, I mean, if you put this outside of this COVID-19 outbreak, the treatment that they're going to give hinges on their diagnosis. And a problem with many respiratory diseases, including, you know, influenza, which is viral in nature, versus, say, a bacterial pneumonia, a lot of viruses present with the same kinds of symptoms, especially initially. So headache, fever, rash, soreness, feeling run down. Just based on that clinical diagnosis, it's hard for medical professionals to say, well, what is it really?
Why does it take so long to get a vaccine for this?
Part of it is we have to identify what is a good target. So with most vaccines, they're built on the idea that you're exposing the person to some physical component of the virus, some protein, right? Some surface, what we would call an antigen. And that's going to stimulate an immune response, primarily the production of antibodies. Mm-hmm. That part, I think there's some pretty good work happening. And also based on what is already known about other coronaviruses, we can do this relatively rapidly, probably in a matter of months. A lot of the time it takes up is safety testing. Vaccines are one of the most heavily tested and highly regulated products that are out there on the market, in spite of public perception about them not being safe. Most estimates that I'm seeing, reasonable estimates, are likely about 18 months.
Do we know if we could get this again if you get it once? Is it one of those things where like the mumps where you never get it again, or could you get this over and over again,
yeah,
like the cold?
Again, this is a question I think everyone, medical and epidemiology, et cetera, is waiting to see what's the difference between coronavirus and flu. They are in different classes, so they're not identical. And part of that is like a flu vaccine will not protect you from coronavirus. But they do have a similarity in that both of them, the genomic material is not DNA, it's RNA. So for us, our genomes are made out of DNA. Theirs are made out of RNA, and so they use a virus-encoded enzyme that copies that RNA into other RNA. And that enzyme makes mistakes. So the flu virus is constantly cranking out new variants of itself. So this is possible. This is possible with the coronavirus because its replication is going to suffer from the same problem. It uses the same kind of enzyme to copy its RNA genome. And so it has the potential to crank out variation just as flu does. But again, since it's just emerged in the human population, I think everyone involved in response to the outbreak is kind of keeping an eye on this, waiting to see what happens.
Kurt Williamson is an associate professor of biology at the College of William and Mary. And as you can see, The thing that really runs through this, the theme that runs through a lot of these interviews and a lot of what we're learning, is that how little is really known. And that is the source of fear, not only a source of fear among people who maybe illogically won't go to a restaurant in Chinatown or something like that, even though there's no problem. And the health department is keeping track of all the different restaurants and all the different places in New York. And there's no outbreaks in New York, that are, making it unsafe to go into the streets. The fact that there might be a problem we don't know about is driving a lot of the fear, the lack of knowledge. So right now, what we have to really be focused on is how do we gain knowledge about this new pathogen that's in our environment. I mean, how are we going to learn about it? Well, we have to turn to
the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. We have to turn to the researchers at Johns Hopkins University. We have to talk to the people in the Department of Health here in New York City. They have to gather data, right? That's what Mayor Bloomberg used to always talk about, data. All others bring me data. We have to look at the data. But to get the data, you have to test. And the problem is there is a tremendous shortage of testing. So we're not getting the data. And the data, they're testing hundreds of thousands of people have been tested already in South Korea. In the United States, as of last night, 1,500 people have been tested. So we have very strict testing protocols and a president who doesn't seem to want to do the testing, right? And who's from what I've been watching, and I know what you know. I know what you know. I mean, I don't have an insider in the White House yet. Maybe I do. I'm not talking about it. But it seems that these folks are contradicting each other. Pence is contradicting Trump, who's contradicting Pence. And they do sometimes in the same news conference. So that's not filling me with – now, my I know libertarian doctors, and they say, oh, this is nothing. Democrats are doing this, right? They're just stirring it up, right? Like the libertarians want to say that there's never a role for government. But I would say that every major health advance that has been made through the government. We'll talk about more of that later on when we have Sherry Lewont on, who's the co-president and co-founder of A Better Balance. And they've been working on paid sick leave and how people will be able to take time off in case there really are problems like we haven't seen in other countries here in the United States. We're going to go now to Dr. Nicole Burwald. She's chair of the emergency department of Staten Island University Hospital. And she tells us a little bit about what we can do in our everyday lives to minimize the effect. The emergency department of Staten Island University Hospital is Dr. Nicole Burwald. She says while coronavirus is serious, there's no need to panic.
The majority of people who get this virus are likely not to get very sick from it. That's the information that we have currently. And the best information we have coming out of the CDC and the Department of Health. But I think we should be prepared for more and more people to get the virus, and with that, be armed with the things that we do that keep us from getting other people sick when you are that person who gets sick. So namely, good hand hygiene, staying at home from work and school, when you do have a cough associated with it, covering your cough, covering your sneeze, when you live with people, not sharing towels, not drinking out of the same glass, to keep some distance between yourself if possible.
How do they know they have it, and how should they respond to the fear?
Liken it to the flu, right? During flu season, there are plenty of people who are home and say, oh, I just know I have the flu, right? I have all the symptoms. I've been in contact with three people who have the flu. I must have the flu too. And that's actually not a bad rationale about these kind of uncontagious viruses. The reality is some people will be tested for this and some people will not be, and they will still have it. It's one of those things where when you know these kind of viruses are in your community, there's a good chance when you feel sick with the similar symptoms that you have it. And I'll say it's my opinion and that of the CDC and the Department of Health and all of the sort of the advisors on this currently, that not everyone will need to be tested. If you have mild symptoms, you're being advised to stay at home, not be in contact with other people. You can contact your physician's office. If you're feeling very sick, obviously you need to go to a hospital. We want to care for every patient who needs care. But someone with mild symptoms, you could assume it's this virus or another. But in reality, you'd be doing the same things for yourself, be it this virus, the influenza virus, or many other seasonal viruses.
And how would you see this playing out? I know nobody has a crystal ball, but how far will it go? And it does have a significantly higher death incidence. Are we going to see an increase in deaths like they saw in Seattle?
So it's really hard to predict what the mortality rate associated with this virus is, because it is my impression, and from the things we've been seeing, that the true denominator, meaning the true number of people who have had this infection in some capacity, really we can't account for them. We're accounting for people by the number of people that we've tested. And currently, given our ability to test and the rigorous nature that's being used to determine who will be tested, many more people are being tested if they are on the sicker end of the spectrum. The actual mortality rate is a difficult one to know or to predict. When I think about what happened in Washington State, it's interesting. A large number of the deaths there happened in a confined space, in a place where we're going to assume that the patients are older and potentially with some comorbid illnesses, which are those patients that we see doing worse with this virus nationally and internationally. Look back at China. So we started to learn about this from them early in February, right? We don't know really when patient zero was. It definitely predates when we started hearing about it. And now a month has passed, and we start to see that their peak has turned down, right? The curve of patients who've been getting it has turned down. And I think we would expect the same thing, that it'll rise up slowly. You'll get your maximum infected rate, and then it will fall back down, like we see with influenza, like they saw in Wuhan.
Who is most at risk?
It appears to be patients who are older or who have some comorbid illnesses, specifically pulmonary issues, seem to be the patients who are being most affected. But that is not really that well understood at this point, that if someone feels significantly ill, they should seek medical attention. That was what we saw out of the other countries who've seen this disease so far. It's really important to remember what your resources are. For people in New York, your listeners, reach out to your local Department of Health if you have questions. The Department of Health, I have been notified, will be having testing centers. You don't always want to go somewhere where you can infect other people if you're sick, and some of those centers would be a good place to go if that was your big concern.
Is there anything besides washing hands people can do to help themselves?
Washing your hands, warm water, a good amount of time, around 30 seconds. Hand sanitizers are fine as well. And to do it frequently, that's probably one of the best things you can do. And keeping yourself away from people who are sick. For a lot of people, that means not going to work, keeping kids home from school, potentially coming up with alternate child care if they have to, because we might see schools or other things closing. That's not the worst thing to plan for. But really trying to confine it the best way that you can.
The worst things we can expect, I mean, could we expect people being forced to stay in their homes and things like that? I mean, where could this go?
If it becomes something where it's really sort of pervasive in our communities, the staying home becomes a little less effective. The idea of staying home is to prevent the spread. Currently, we're guiding people, if they have been in contact with someone, if they're known sick, to stay isolated. But I think you come to a line, and that hasn't yet been determined, and if it were to get widespread enough where that becomes a little less efficacious, and the recommendations would likely change.
And Dr. Nicole Burwald is chair of the Emergency Department of Staten Island University Hospital.
Welcome back. I'm Paul D'Arienzo, WBAI New York. It's 12:23, and we're in our special programming. We're talking about, we're going to be talking with you later on about just exactly your fears and what you think you've been doing, what to do, what you've been doing. You know, I'm curious what people are out there are doing to protect themselves if they feel they even have to. Maybe this is just a Democratic plot against the president. We can find that out, and we'll take your calls later on. But there's an aspect of this that came to my attention when I was reading the news today, and I found it fascinating. Of course, let's say the things that Dr. Nicole Burwald was just talking about come to pass, and people are students don't go to school and people don't go to work. What happens to their paycheck? I mean, the rent still has to be collected, even if you can't use the subways or if you can't go to work or your business has been shuttered or you've been isolated. What happens then? And to me, that's connected, of course, to the whole idea of healthcare, because wouldn't this problem be a lot easier and a lot less stressful and stress producing if we had single payer health insurance at this moment? But, you know, that's just me talking. So we've brought in Sherry Lewant, and she can, I hope I pronounce it correctly. She's the co-president and co-founder of A Better Balance. And I came across her name because of folks were from A Better Balance and other groups were out protesting at Chipotle. And it was about the whole idea of paid sick leave. So welcome, Sherry Lewant, to WBAI.
Thank you so much, and thanks for focusing on sick leave, on the effect that this is going to have on workers and their families, if there is widespread quarantine, or even if people are sick. And that, you know, I was just hearing you speaking with the last speaker, who is, you know, advising people at least at this point to stem the spread by possibly staying home, possibly keeping your kids home from school, certainly not going out into the community if you have symptoms or you're really ill. And it's a great opportunity to, first of all, remind people in New York City that we do have a paid sick days law. We fought very hard to get that law in 2013, and it was improved in 2014 by the current mayor, and people are entitled to 5 days, 40 hours of paid sick time. So no one should, at least for that period of time, worry about their paycheck. That is something that that all New Yorkers who work pretty much are entitled to. So I think a lot of people don't realize that or don't know that. There are also many places of business that give you even more time. In the paid sick time law that we passed, because we passed it around the time of the swine flu epidemic, H1N1, there is a provision that you can use your sick leave if your child's school is closed or if your place of business is closed. So even if you yourself are not sick, but there's a public health emergency and an order to close those places, you're entitled to use your sick leave. So I think it's important for people to know that, because you can't expect people to sacrifice even a paycheck for one day, particularly for people who live paycheck to paycheck, if their symptoms are mild or they feel like they can go to work, but it may not be the best thing for them to do.
Yeah, why was Chipotle chosen as the place for the protest yesterday?
Well, Chipotle, I mean, this is a right in New York City. It's a right in 11 states and about 25 localities have these laws. There's always a problem with employers who don't follow the law, and there have been problems at Chipotle and for people who are trying to access their paid sick time. So that's why. And obviously, for all of us, in terms of public health, places like Chipotle, fast food restaurants, retail, it's very, very important that employers in those industries take this very seriously and make sure they follow the law when it comes to paid sick time.
Right. And tell us more about paid sick time in New York. How did it it's hard to believe that so many people did not have that. And now they do. How does it work, actually? And how is it? How do people get around it? What to look out for? Because, as you said, a lot of people don't know about it. So how do they approach their boss to collect it?
Well, I think, and particularly at this moment when people are so focused on the public health aspects of being able to stay home if they're sick, this is a great time to, I know people are fearful to approach their bosses about, especially in vulnerable industries, about anything that they feel like they should be getting. But I think this is a great time to remind employers if your employment area does not tell you that you have paid sick time, that you do, and there is a right to that in New York City. Paul, it's really great that you said that. Most people who have paid sick time in their employment can't believe how many people, about 32 million in the United States, don't have a single day of paid sick time. And so we have been fighting to get these laws passed, and over the last 10 to 12 years, we've gotten a lot of them passed in states and localities. There's a hearing next week in Washington on a federal proposal to require paid sick time for all workers in the United States, and we would really love to see that happen. There's also a proposal now that was just dropped yesterday in the United States Senate to pass a paid sick days bill that would also have some additional time if there's a public health emergency. So there is work being done to try to make sure that, as a basic employment right, just like minimum wage, everybody should have paid sick time.
Uh-huh. And I guess I don't know, because we're in an area of unknown for all of us in a lot of ways. I don't think we've had something like this happen in this country, not in the era of mass communications anyway, in a very, very long time. How what happens if we have to stay, like some of these folks have been in there being held for weeks now in cruise ships. And there's actually people, yesterday was reported as 4,000 people already in New York State who are in isolation, and 44 of them required right now. And in New York City alone, 2,700 people have been forced to self-isolate. What happens if people can't go to work for more than 5 days?
Yeah, and I think that is a problem, and that is an issue. And I should say, and I, you know, we're very proud of the law in New York City because we worked really hard to pass it. And you know, it didn't go into effect till 2014. It is a New York City law, and we also passed one in Westchester. But further upstate, there are no protections, and the governor has actually included in his budget a proposal to have require paid sick days for the entire state, and we're working with him on that, and we're hoping that that will pass, and we expect legislators to support that. In answer to your question, you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, 40 hours or 5 days is not sufficient, and I think an emergency like this, there should be some vehicle for getting some kind of support to workers that have to be out for longer, but at least the time that you are entitled to will help.
Can you be fired actually even if you're required not to go to work? If the government says you can't go to work, can you still be fired?
Well, I think that's an excellent question too.
I don't have any idea.
You can't be fired for those 40 hours. There is job protection for those 40 hours. There's job protection in the proposal, in the governor's proposal. But you know, above that, I think if you're actually sick, we also have something in the New York State called the paid. We have paid family leave, so you can take care of anybody who's sick in your household, and temporary disability insurance as well. So for a longer term, you could apply for those benefits, but that's a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated than
we're talking about FEMA and things like that now. Now we're talking the federal government has to move in and FEMA and disaster relief and that kind
of thing. Yeah, yeah, for a very long, you know, I think that there will have to be a response. But I do, you know, and I really appreciate your focusing on this, Paul, because part of that response has to be the economic security of workers who are going to have to be home or who are going to have to be home with their kids. And I think sick leave and requiring sick leave is a partial response to that, and definitely is a response that we should have even if there's not an epidemic. But, you know, in this time of really fearing for longer periods of time, we're going to have to find some way to support workers as well as to make sure that the public health. And they're really related, obviously. You know, you really can't tell people that they have to stay home if they're not going to be able to earn money and pay the rent and buy food for their kids.
They'll just go out anyway, and they'll just work anyway, and then the virus will be spread anyway.
Exactly. So this is a first line of defense against against the spread.
Very good. How can people learn more about this and stay in touch with what you're doing?
Well, by all means, go to our website. That's betterbalance.org. We have updates on there. We'll have updates on both the statewide efforts by the governor and efforts by the mayor, and also on the federal work that we're doing to try to combat this virus and make sure that that workers aren't forgotten.
All right, very good. Thank you very much for joining us. Anything we missed that you think we should know about before we move on with the show?
No. I just I again appreciate your focusing on this issue, and you know, I hope everybody, all your listeners, will realize that they do have some protections in the law with respect to their earnings and with respect to their jobs if they do get sick or if they do have to stay home.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Sherry Lewant, co-president and co-founder of A Better Balance, the Work and Family Legal Center. And we were talking about paid sick leave, which we have now in New York City and in Westchester County, and how that might, at least for the first 40 hours of any sort of isolation, they call it, not quarantine, the official word, you're covered and you're safe. But beyond that, we don't know. It becomes a natural disaster in a sense. I'm going to bring in the federal government. Oh, my God. Let's go and have a little musical break. You're listening to WBAI New York. and we'll be back in a few minutes. Take your calls.
They came from way far out in outer space. She's hard to miss, and so they landed on her face. She's got cooties. They found a place to nest. If I were her, I'd be depressed. Long tail, sharp nail, fuzzy legs, laying eggs. Oh no, get them all. In science class, she's like a walking show and tell. Her pets come ran away cause couldn't take the smell. She's got cooties. Nobody wants to sit by her. No, don't need a coat, cause she's got fur. Circle, circle, da, da, da. Glad I got my cootie shot.
Every 10 years, America mounts a census and attempts to count every single person living in the country, citizens and non-citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. This is an extremely difficult goal, even under ideal circumstances. And even as the actions of the current U.S. government has created fear and uncertainty that all but ensures that many immigrants will stay in the shadows, too terrified to risk contact with any governmental official, census takers included. However, by law, namely Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any information about you, your business, or your immigration status to law enforcement. So step out of the shadows, stand up and be counted. This is a public service of WBAI Community Outreach.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
And welcome back. I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is a special program on the coronavirus. This is the part where you get to tell us what you think and let the we can have community outreach, right? That's what we call it, WBAI Community Outreach. That's what we're best at, community outreach, and that's why we're here. And we're here to reach out to the community. Our call-in number is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. And we want to have your response to the pandemic, your response to the response, what you think, what you're doing, what your opinion is about what people should be doing, how you react when people start sneezing on a subway, things like that, little things, right? That's what life is about, is all the little things that happen. So reach over, you can give us a call, you can hear on the line. As we said, it's been one of the most telling experiences is that, you know, the South by Southwest Music Festival is in Austin, Texas, has been canceled. That music festivals in Florida have been canceled. That the NCAA Division III men's basketball tournament at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore is going to be held without spectators in empty rooms. I mean, these are odd events to have happen. And it makes you wonder, are you a prepper? Are you preparing for it? Do you have things set up? Do you have a go bag? What are you doing? Or are you just going to sit it out? Hi, you're on the air. Welcome to WBAI. Go ahead. Question or comment?
Oh, Mr. Torianza, how you doing?
How you doing? Great. Where are you calling from?
I'm actually from the Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to say you do a great job with the BAI Evening News.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Appreciate that you listen. We do all do, because it's a team effort for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the fact of the matter is, amidst this outbreak, the reality is people are still have to go to work, because most of us, like you said, the 99% have to pay rent and car notes. And, like, I don't have no kids, but I can imagine.
I don't see the landlord, right, doing that, like saying all of a sudden, oh, I'm going to forgive you the rent.
Right.
Sorry about that. Yeah, we got it, but really be careful about that. It can get us. That's a big fine. All right, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
That's right.
Yeah.
We got you. I think we good.
That's the fact of the matter. People have to go to work. And, yeah, it's true. I checked Duane Reade, CVS, Dollar Tree, all those discount stores, all the sanitizers sold out.
Really?
Literally, yeah.
Wow. Well, I hope soap isn't sold out. I've spent a lot of time as a school teacher, and we teach kids how to wash their hands, because they never do it right when they come in, because there's a procedure to it. And basically what you do is you wet your hands, you soap them up, and then you sing Happy Birthday. And you sing it all the way through while you're washing your hands, and then you rinse and dry.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like, actually, so I hope you're doing that. So don't worry about the alcohol. That's bad for your skin anyway, all that alcohol on your skin. It's not good for you. It's best to use soap, normal, beautiful soap. It should not, I hope, does not go disappear from the shelves. All right. Thank you very much, caller. We're going to go to the next. All right. If there's any teachers out there, how do you handle it when you have kids? I mean, teachers, we're like, we know what germs are all about, right? All right. Go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon, and thank you for your program. It's quite exceptional.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it.
You're welcome. I wanted to say a couple of things. I'd like the general public, you know, to start to get in touch with their congresspersons, assemblypersons, senators, et cetera, and start to instruct them as to what they feel needs to be done, particularly WBAI listeners. We have privy to a lot of information that other listeners or other, you know, media listeners don't have, and viewers. Well, Gary Knowles was speaking about the 14-day quarantine, particularly for people who are coming in from high-risk locations. You know, we should call our assemblypersons, congresspersons, and request that that be a policy.
That people be quarantined. I think it might be. Well, actually, it's called isolation. That's the official
whatever
term.
Whatever nonsense they want to come with. You know what I'm saying? The fact is that they're...
Well, they might have to do this kind of thing, you know?
Like, you're saying they might...
Yeah, well,
we should really, as the public, tell them what we want them to do. Because right now, they're not telling us anything that makes any sense.
Right. That's what I have to say. I don't want to directly give advice except how to wash your hands, because I learned that specifically
how to do that.
But
that's aside,
I was actually
a caller.
Yeah.
And just one other thing that I wanted to say. I'm noticing that we have quite a few businesses and hotels and what have you that have owners that are slipping from the Orient. And I've been hearing that some of those owners are just trying to send employees from the Orient into the United States to kind of support the overall operations and businesses in the United States. And I think at this time we should have a moratorium on that kind of thing.
Okay, we're going to leave that out. I'm not going to have an opinion on that. I'm going to leave it for the people to talk about. But I can see the fear. I can see how people fear that. I think it's here. It's among us. It's too late. It's already the testing. That's why they don't want to test, because it's already here. We all probably have it, and most of us had mild cases, didn't even realize we had it. It's the poor people in the old age homes and places like that. I don't know. What's the politically correct term for an old age home? An old age home, right? An old age home. All right. So you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, Paul, I have to be honest with you. I think this coronavirus thing has been hyped beyond our wildest.
I have a friend of mine who's a doctor, medical doctor, psychiatrist. He's not a virologist, but he says the same thing.
He's just one person. I'm flying on airplanes all week. I am not at the least bit concerned. I have four kids, and now I'm hearing that they may close the schools, not because there's coronavirus, but they need to train on how to deal with it. How about the flu and the lice and all the other stuff that they have? I mean, come on. I mean, what, 12,000 people have already died in the United States of flu this year? Okay.
Right.
How many have died from this coronavirus, and who were they?
Right.
You notice that every time they report a new death, they don't tell you who it was or what their circumstances were?
Right. Well,
if you're 90 years old and you have a compromised immune system, you know what? Yeah, the flu is pretty serious, and you don't want anything to happen to those people.
Right.
But come on. I mean...
Well, can I say this? I understand what you're saying, and I think that earlier when we talked to when we heard from the doctor at Staten Island University, and she was talking about these are what you're saying is logical, you know, thought. You know, it's not like an illogical thought pattern. We don't see it among us, and it doesn't. We don't have the testing to know. And I think right now, and it might even be too late for that. Actually, is the massive testing would have been really a good idea. And to me, the larger issue, which is why I wanted to bring in the whole issue of how we're going to pay people who can't go to work in case they start telling people they can't go to work, is wouldn't it have been better if we had a health system that could do the checks necessary and provide the data so that we wouldn't be
Here's the thing. Along those lines, okay, they talk about how, this has a fatality rate of 2.5%. Okay, now, the last time I remember, the way to calculate a percentage is you need a numerator and a denominator.
Right. Well, that's what we're talking about.
Testing, the only people getting tested are people who haven't. How many people have it? They aren't getting tested.
But they're being that's the point I'm trying to make. That they have not rolled out the testing. There's only 1,500 as of last night. I heard on the news 1,500 people have been tested in the United States. That's ridiculous. It's 150,000 I heard in South Korea. Why aren't we testing?
And
it's already too late because it's already out there.
I understand, but it's just like any other illness. It's like, okay, so I have the flu. It doesn't mean I'm going to go get tested.
Well, there was a scary thing in Seattle. 10 people died really quickly, so they're worried. I mean, their job is to be worried.
Community, right?
There's nothing wrong being paranoid. You know, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not trying to get me. So there's nothing wrong with having a health system that's job is to look into these kind of things. But we don't even have that in this country. That's to me the issue.
Oh, wait a second. You can't tell me that the United States doesn't have a superior health care system.
But it doesn't have it at the level.
I've lived in other countries.
Yeah, but it's not testing.
You want to go to Mexico and try theirs?
The data is – in Mexico, they generate data at least. They know what's going on in their country. People who can afford the health care, what their problem is. And this comes up. It's not the first time this has come up. Many,
but
many
UK,
times.
You trust
many,
those
many
numbers
times.
Too? I mean, come on.
I think you're wrong there. I think that it's worked very well in these countries. You're poo-pooing them.
If you have a serious illness, Paul, where do you come?
You're poo-pooing.
Where does everybody come?
Wait. You're poo-pooing the experience in these other countries. And I, to be honest with you, I talk to people in Canada, and we talk to people who've studied the situation in Canada, and they love it. All right? They love it. There's always somebody who has a complaint. And if you collect all the people who have complaints and then give them a microphone, you think it's a bad system. But when you talk to everybody, the millions of people who use it every year, quite the other story. All right, let's go on to the next caller. You're on the radio. Go ahead. You're on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. I guess you're not there. We'll go for another person. Stay on the line because I might take a minute to get you. All right, you're on the radio.
Hey, good afternoon. Steve calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Steve. What's up?
Hey, that last caller was either a health insurance provider or a Trump supporter. That's all I'll say.
Right. Well, when they, you know, a libertarian point of view which could overwhelm, not necessarily be those things you mentioned, but which overlap with them, is that there's no need for the government to get involved. Somehow the markets, the invisible hand of the market, will take care of everything. And since laissez-faire in the 19th century, there's been people pushing that. And it's in the... You can't use 19th and 20th century healthcare models in a 21st century world with 10 billion people, global warming, and all these things happening. You have to ramp it up. We have to ramp it up.
You heard what the National Nurses United came out with, a statement they made the other day, right?
Tell me. Tell us.
That the USA is willfully unprepared for the pandemic of the coronavirus or any other pandemic.
And right. That's what I've been hearing. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if this is not you're right, a thing for single payer health care for everybody, then what the hell do we have? What are we even worried about health care for then?
Right. I don't really understand how people are so, and it's always the wealthier people.
Oh, they don't want it.
It's not entirely, and many of the wealthier people are supporters of what we're talking about. I don't want to unfairly slag anybody, but you know, obviously the people who can afford medical care, who have great insurance, you know, who are covered by big institutions, and who are themselves often professionals and see other doctors who are professionals, and they can even socialize with them, you know, at different times. Of course, they have nothing to worry about, they think.
Hey, and we haven't heard from the Cuban doctors yet, because we got to remember, the Cuban doctors would save the world from the cholera epidemic that was brought to Haiti by the UN peacekeepers, right?
Right, so and Haiti is second to none. Cuba is second to none medical care for the people. Even today, they've managed to survive even through all the blockades and assaults on
economic
it.
Economic sanctions.
Yeah.
And who was the first ones to respond to Katrina? Remember? Fidel Castro was going to send 677 doctors with backpacks, self-contained, to go to Katrina, and George Bush never called him back.
Right. Katrina's another one. I like to open. We have a lot of calls.
Tell everybody with symptoms, go to the White House, see Dr. Pence and Dr. Trump.
All right. Thank you very much. Sherry Fink, I interviewed, did a book about what happened during Katrina at Memorial Hospital, and it was very interesting. The poor neighborhood hospital, upper middle class hospital actually euthanized as many as 40 patients because they didn't know what to do. But in the poor charity hospital on the other side of town, which is one of the famous charity hospitals of New Orleans, the famous free hospital that was built in a state that doesn't give free anything, right? They never had any of those problems because they were so used to having nothing. When they lost the electricity, they had a million ways to fall back. But the people in the middle class, upper middle class hospital, didn't know what to do when they had nothing. And that led to euthanizing patients. But that did not happen in the charity hospital. I find that interesting. Sherry Fink's book, 5 Days of Memorial. Check it out. You're on the radio.
Hi. So something very strange is going on in hospitals here in New York. My girlfriend is a lab supervisor in one of the major New York City hospitals. Of course, I won't mention which one. But she's telling me that it is the governor's office who is calling the labs and directing the response to this virus and how the hospital should deal with it, rather than the New York State Department of Health. And the people who run the labs are like, why are we talking to political operatives in the governor's office and not the New York State Department of Health officials?
That's a Cuomo thing. He did that with the L train. I don't know if you're familiar. I actually lived near the L train,
yeah.
and the L train was going, the tunnel was going to be closed for a couple of years, and he stepped in and ordered a change in the construction process that it would be done in 18 months. Everybody's happy it's done in 18 months, but it leaves me scratching my head because they said it would be a couple of years, and now all of a sudden it's 18 months. What's going on? You know, the mayor just gave an order to – I know that it would have hurt a lot of people and destroyed the economy in a couple of neighborhoods if that original closing had gone through. But you wonder, is it a proper decision that was made?
Yeah, well, the L train is one thing, but what do political people in his office
That's what I mean. That's what I'm referring to. Yeah. And what has in my neighborhood in the Lower East Side is it's a political decision to build a flood control project. Why do they know? Politicians and city council people sit down and tell us what has to be done. I want to talk to the experts, and there's no environmental impact statement, no experts involved at all. The folks at Brooklyn Heights, not far from where we are right now, were able to stop them from destroying the promenade in order to build a 6-lane highway underneath there. They had some – that's what we need more of. We need more – once independent people look at it, they say this is a terrible job, terrible project. It shouldn't be done.
Yeah. So people should know, I mean, that these decisions, you know, are being made not by the people who should be involved when it comes to this coronavirus.
Right.
And I do think it's
not the experts. Yeah. It should be the experts.
People criticize Trump, but, you know, we got the guy right here in our state who's 10 times worse.
All right. Good. I'm going to keep that. Thank you. Right. Very political, right? Everything's so politicized, and it's, and I feel no wonder people are confused, right? Because when you apply politics, it's so weird. All right, one more call. Can we get in one more? No, that's it. We're out of time. All right, thank you for joining us. That's what happens. We have so much fun that the clock just goes right on by. So I'm Paul DiRienzo. This has been a special on the coronavirus. We'll be following this very closely in the days and weeks to come. Thank you, and stay tuned for the next program. And watch out for them cooties.
They came from way far out in outer space. She's hard to miss, and so they landed on her face. They found a place to nest. If I were her, I'd be depressed. Long tail, sharp nail, fuzzy legs, laying eggs. Oh no, get off. In science class, she's like a walking show and tell. Her pets done ran away cause could pick the smell. She's got cooties. Nobody wants to sit by her. No, don't need a coat cause she's got fur. Circle, circle, da, da, da. Glad I got my cootie shot.